mean, this is not an easy case to work through, okay? We're talking about statutory interpretation at its worst.
I've got it here. I'm not going to tell you for a couple of days since I read this.
What'd I tell you about that excuse?
Like I said, I got it in here, that's why I'm reading it. You don't want me to get into all the conspiracy aspect of the record?
No, the conspiracy stuff actually is mundane. What is really at stake here is what did the legislature intend? What did the Congress intend when it enacted this annoying and harassing phone call statute? You know, we're talking about mens rea, we're talking about intent, and so one of the questions that ought to arise in your minds is whether this is a general intent crime or a specific intent crime. You know, does the defendant have to have a particular objective, or is simply making the phone call under particular circumstances enough to satisfy the mens rea in this case?
My understanding of this was that it was specific, even from the point of view of the government office, that it was specific, but that his interpretation of that arrest just went beyond, you know, that doing this calling and hanging up business was harassing, and that he intended to harass, or at least, you know, the people that he gave the, you know, information to.
Well, that may be the bottom line, but again, imagine you're sitting on the appeals court in the First Circuit. This case has come to you. The issues have been laid out for you, and you have to pick one. You don't have to pick one of the two arguments advanced by the side, but you've got to come to a conclusion as to what does it mean, what the language means, to harass. And so that's the question that the court is trying to answer. And while we return to your brief for a moment, okay, what is your holding in terms of the brief, your brief?
The rule that I came up with out of that was that the legal definition and the history of the term harass as it pertains to telephone calls requires public communication and disruption is not the same as communication.
Okay. And when you wrote that, what did it mean to you?
What it meant to me was that the law was very specific what the intent had to be. It had to be to harass. So now we get into this business of now defining harassment. What this would need to be is that's what harass is going to mean for this.
Okay. Now we'll come back to you, Ms. Moses. What did you have as the holding or rule of law from this case? Well, I assume that you were engaged in the discussion and so that you could pull it right up, you know?
Yeah, I bring it up to that.
Yeah, but now you're doing what I don't want you to do in the sentence, you're going over the facts again. Yes?
So you must look at the intent of the behavior.
Okay. And what is it?
State of mind required for the decision.
Okay, I agree that we're looking at, we're trying to figure out what state of mind is necessary for the conviction. But the court has to tell us that. What is it?
Purpose.
Purpose? Okay, purpose, what does that mean? Purpose what?
Desire to.
I'm sorry?
A desire.
A desire to what?
To harass, to keep calling, to, yeah, what would they
mean? Well, can I get involved in this conversation?
It said to, because when the judge gave the jury the definition, it said, in the context of this case, the word harass means and describes conduct that is intentionally designed not to communicate, but instead to impede, distract, disrupt. So the purpose to disrupt people and harass them in that way.
Okay.
Cause emotional distress.
Yes.
I think what happened is the defendant's arguing this is a specific intent crime, and that the instructions given by the judge to the jury, because the jury was really confused as much as we are, and so he tried to come to a compromise when he was explaining to them how to do it, and in so doing, the argument of the defendant is he broadened the definition so much that it was no, the specificity was diluted. So he said, if you look, it's on 148, sort of, it says, he said, it's an intent to harass. If you intentionally employ the phone that is not meant as, here's what he argued, a good faith effort to communicate, and that it's done with unjustifiable motive. So the argument, what's his name?
Tobin.
Thank you, Tobin, is that's too broad. That's not what the law says. It doesn't say you have to, just as you're ringing the phone. It doesn't say about communicate. It doesn't say unjustifiable motive. So he's arguing that the instruction had the jury convince him because they broadened the definition, and had the jury been given the right instruction, they would not have convicted him. That's his argument.
Okay. Let me say something here, because I normally mention this and didn't this time, and that's just an oversight. When we talk about intent in terms of mens rea, we're not talking about motive. Motive may end up being a way that you prove mens rea, but they're separate concepts. When we talk about the law and intent, we're saying, what must the government prove in order to get a conviction? And again, I go back to the example that I've used several times now. Sal DeMacy's argument is that, yes, he intended to help a constituent, but he didn't do so with the intent of any personal gain. And he was doing it for a legislative purpose, which is legal. And so to some extent, what the defendant is arguing here is that there's nothing wrong with me making phone calls. And that's why we have phones, so you can make phone calls. That this harassment statute, and in fact he's correct, this harassment statute is you know, what does it mean to knowingly harass? And is this a specific intent crime or a general intent crime? But because the federal, when I talk about model penal code jurisdictions, much of the federal law is now written in model penal code language. And so, to some extent, we're asking, does the defendant, in fact, have to know or act with the purpose of causing harm? You know, emotional distress or whatever to the people on the other end of the phone? Or is it enough that the defendant should know that the behavior is likely to result in mental distress? And the court opts for it's enough that the person should know. You don't have to be a mind reader. And so to some extent, what is going on here is the court saying this is a choice between a subjective test, which is a true example of specific intent, and is probably a true example of a purposeful means or intentional means. Or is it something less than that? And part of what makes this discussion difficult is the trial judge is someplace else. I don't know where the heck the trial judge was in this. And that's what makes this case difficult to read. Part of the reason that I've focused on this case is that it shows the difficulties of statutory instruction. You know, the court talks about what a dictionary says the word means. And then it throws out the definition of the dictionary, used in the dictionary, right? And then it says, okay, well, what did the Congress mean? And so anytime the Congress enacts a piece of legislation, there's a debate, there's discussion, there are reports. And so, you know, the court says, well, let's take a look to see if we can tell what the congressional intent was from there. But they don't like the congressional intent because this particular law apparently was enacted during the Vietnam War. And, you know, had a particular thing in mind. And what they had in mind was not what is happening here. So, you know, it is worth noting that the court says, doggone, and we're going to remand this, but, you know, the legislature needs to clean this mess up. You know, you can't dump this on us. That's not our job. You know, we try to divine what you mean, but sometimes you got to give us a hint. And you didn't give us much of a hint. So Tobin is difficult to read. It's supposed to be difficult to read. It's supposed to leave you a little bit confusing. Part of the reason that I mentioned this was the First Circuit is because Massachusetts has a statute very similar to what the federal government has. And at the time that I tried an annoying and harassing phone call case, the question was, how many phone calls have to be made for it to rise to the level of annoying and harassing? Is it enough for one? And the answer to that was no. Two, probably not. But three and beyond, yeah, we're in that whatever. In my case, there were 21 phone calls, so it was easy call, right? But you know, it ended up going to either the appeals court or the SJC to sort of talk about that issue, but also to talk about the fact that the trial judge had gotten creative, like this trial judge, in the jury instruction, and the trial judge had screwed up the instruction on what beyond reasonable doubt means, and so the case got tipped and sent back for retrial. So, the good thing about the Tobin case is that it is real. It is real. But what's the takeaway from it? First of all, you need to be able to look at a law and tell what is the actus reus, what is the mens rea, in other words, what acts must the government prove, what intent must the government prove. Are we talking model penal code? Are we talking specific intent, general intent, those kinds of things? When we talk about statutory interpretation that, and we talked about this a little bit, is that it can be dictionaries, it could also be precedent. And, you know, one of the odd things about this Tobin case is that apparently there was no precedent in the First Circuit on this particular issue, which is kind of a surprise to me. Because the case that I'm talking about, that I tried it more than 30 years ago. And so, to some extent, at least in Massachusetts, many of these issues have been resolved, but it had not been resolved at the federal level. And, you know, because arguably, and it doesn't show itself, but part of what is being argued here is that, you know, we're exercising First Amendment rights here to some extent. And so, you know, we ought to have some leeway, but that argument is never made because they understand that that's not going to hold up. But that's the subtext of this argument. Okay, let's take a look at 153, the Fabritz case. Marissa, I'm sorry. Okay.
All right. Fabrice left her daughter in the care of the Crockett's, which is the people that she lived with, to go to her grandfather's funeral. When she got her child back, her child was suffering from cramps and flu-like symptoms. At 5 o'clock, she seemed semi-conscious and improved, and she gave her liquids. Around 6, she was vomiting and gave her more liquid. She then called her neighbor for assistance. They bathed her in alcohol, and she seemed half asleep. The neighbor asked about bruises on the child's body. Fabrice then decided to call the hospital and was advised to bring her in. She wasn't breathing. Fabrice gave her CPR. When she was taken by the ambulance, Fabrice was hysterical and went to the hospital. She told her neighbor that she felt like it was her fault that she killed her. The examiner said that 18 to 24 hours prior, Lindy had been hit in the abdomen by a blunt instrument,
okay,
probably a fist.
And was the mother present at that time?
No.
Okay. Why wasn't she present?
She, when her child was hit?
Yeah.
She was at the funeral.
Okay. I just want to be clear. Mother is not on the scene at the time that the injury is sustained. In terms of the procedural history here, what law is mom charged with violating?
Well, it said that she was then convicted and for abuse, delayed medical attention.
Okay, so she's convicted. So she's convicted of child abuse.
Yes.
The government's theory is that her failure to get her medical attention, is that correct?
Yes.
I'll go back to the question again. This opinion is from where?
District Court? It's for refused. She got 8 days to prepare for refused.
Right.
District Court, then the appeals.
Okay. And the appeals court is where?
Maryland.
Is it? It's wherever the Fourth Circuit sits, okay?
Okay.
All right, part of what I want you to understand is mother is convicted of a state crime, okay? She is convicted of violating Maryland law. Mother at some point files for a writ of habeas corpus in district court. And for reasons that are not clear to me, she files in the district court of Virginia, the federal district court of Virginia. Now, I don't know whether Maryland and Virginia had some sort of compact where certain types of offenders would be held in Virginia. I don't know why she didn't file in the federal district court in Maryland, but for some strange reason, this Maryland case ends up before a Virginia district court, which is why it was probably summarily denied. Say, what the hell do we care about this? This was in another state. since this ends up in federal court, what is the so-called federal issue? I mean, what's the heart of mom's claim here?
Well, she's saying that she had no knowledge that she was risking her child's life.
That's what will happen if she's allowed to get a second trial. That's what she will prove. But that alone would not be enough to get her into federal court. She has to allege something else. Yes, what?
That the statute was unconstitutionally applied.
In what way? You're right, but yes, go.
She failed to prove, right?
Right, that's right. She's arguing that there was insufficient evidence to support the finding of guilt. And so when someone is convicted on the basis of an insufficient evidence, you're arguing that their due process rights were violated, okay? So this is another due process claim. Now let's take a look at the Maryland statute. And it's at the bottom of page 153. And so we're given the penalty. And so what must a parent do, or whatever, in order to be guilty of abuse?
Cause the abuse.
Cause the abuse. So that's one. Or?
Resulting cruel or inhumane treatment.
Okay. So again, we've got to figure out, what's the government's theory of the act, of mom's act here? Is the government saying that mom caused the blunt trauma? Wrist looked down now, so. Mom couldn't have caused the trauma, could she?
No, she wasn't there.
She wasn't there. So what's the government going to argue then in terms of this law? Yes.
That it was totally inhumane to hold her from a hospital, or withhold her from a hospital and get a medical treatment.
Yeah. Mom knew that she was sick and didn't take her to the hospital. So the government is saying you committed child abuse by failing to take your child to the hospital. Okay? And what's the mens rea? Can you be guilty of this crime by accidentally not taking your child to the hospital? Say no?
Intentionally.
Yeah, there's some level of intent here. You've got to have some knowledge of that. We're talking again about the failure to act. And so, the government has to prove that she knew that the child was in grave danger and then did nothing. And according to the court in this case, what do they say about all of that? You can come up for air numbers. What's the bottom line here?
That it might have been an error of judgment, but she wasn't really aware that she was wrongdoing on her part?
Yeah. Saying she didn't know. And in fact, there's a fair amount of evidence to show the proof that she didn't know. And more importantly, she was acting in a responsible way, or at least trying to. I mean, she didn't ignore the child's suffering. She tried to comfort the child. She just didn't know the gravity of the child's injuries, and so she didn't get her to the hospital. Think about the public policy implications of a case like this if we allow this conviction to stand. Then we get to question the judgment of every parent. And do we really want the state doing that? What we want is some evidence of intent to cause the harm. Yes?
Well, this question is, I kind of agree with the dissenting judge on this. It seems like there was plenty of evidence, especially when she says something like Tommy hit her.
Yes.
So it's not one incident. I mean, she's known about him doing that already.
Yeah, I mean, part of what should happen is that on other facts, perhaps you can find that she was an abuser. But on the facts as we see them in the record, we probably don't have enough. If the government wants to show that there's a long history of Tommy abusing the child, then that's one thing. But everything that we have sounds like a mother who is suspicious of what happened and is blaming herself for not being more attentive. And that doesn't... The Maryland statute requires that the person know about the harm, and she didn't know about the harm because she wasn't there. Everything she's saying is speculation. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, sir, one more question.
I think that the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit actually sits in Virginia, not in... But if you look at to where the habeas was filed in the District Court of Virginia. Now, Maryland and Virginia are in the same circuit, so it doesn't matter.
So, like, the first line, after that, I thought her name was as confusing. Is her name Virginia Babbitts, or is the District Court to Virginia?
No, her name, she's the petitioner. Okay. So, yes, her name is Babbitts.
But not Virginia Babbitts?
No, for Virginia.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. You're a state. No, I'm sorry. No, her name is, we can call her Ginny Fabrics, okay? Why don't we take 5 or 10 and then we'll come back and get blown, okay? Take 10, come on back.
See, part of my problem is I can never figure out where your lines are going. Again, if you're in class, I'll call out your journals.
And Is it Andrea?
Correct.
Andrea.
Andrea.
Andrea. My cousin says it's Andrea. She was born in the other thing, but, you know, if I call her that, now she gets an attitude, so. But, okay. State versus Fiero.
Okay, the defendant shoots Victor Corella once in the chest and four times in the head. Corella is taken to the hospital. A surgery is performed in an effort to control the bleeding. An exam reveals that he had suffered brain death. Corella stayed on life support systems for the next 3 days, and it was reconfirmed that his brain was indeed dead. Because of the brain death, the surgeon testified that the measures should be terminated, and Corella was...
What measures? I'm not sure that you said what the measures were.
That the support should be terminated.
Okay.
And Corella was pronounced dead. Both medical examiners testified that the cause of death was multiple gunshot wounds to the head. The defendant was found guilty of first-degree murder by trial by jury and was sentenced to life imprisonment. The question he is appealing was the termination of support systems the true cause of death, making the evidence supporting the judgment of guilt insufficient to convict the defendant?
Okay. So the question is it who killed Ray?
Yes.
The question is, who killed Ray? Right? What does the court say?
That the proximate cause of death was the gunshot wounds, not the removal of the support system. Therefore, there was no error in finding that the defendant was the cause of the victim's death.
Well, how can that be? You told me that the docs unplugged them. How come the docs aren't responsible?
Because, they said that it's not indispensable to a conviction that the wounds be fatal and the direct cause of death. It's sufficient that they cause death indirectly through a chain of natural effects and causes unchanged by human action. So basically, if he hadn't, his shooting didn't have to directly cause the death.
Is that what Fiero stands for? Is that the rule that comes out of Fiero? You all are silent? Does that mean you agree? Yes.
I got out of it is that the definition of death as opposed to common law where it pretty well defines the cessation of respiration, breathing, pulse, etc. That do advances in medical science where it's possible to keep those things going, but yet still have what they call brain death. So in this case, basically, it's held that once you've brained it, you're dead, and that the actions of the defendant causes the brain death and thus death. So that, in fact, he was guilty of first-degree murder on that basis.
Okay. Yeah. Again, we talk about common law. This is an example of a state Supreme Court changing the rule of law in Arizona. In Arizona, the law had been essentially that you were dead when a person stopped breathing. And so to some extent, what the defendant in this case is doing is trying to rely upon precedent to say that I'm not responsible for the death here. And the court says, no, no, no. We've got experts who say that this victim was brain dead when he was admitted or after they finished doing everything that they could do for him. And Andrea, do you have any sense of what brain death means?
Me or what they're saying?
You. I don't care what they say. I want to listen to them. Listen to you.
They're basically eventual. Your brain can't send like the necessary signals for your body to work properly.
Okay. Yeah. Anyone else? Anybody with a medical background? Yes.
I'm responsive to normally painful stimuli in the absence of spontaneous movements or breathing in the absence of reflexes.
Yeah. Because I want to be careful. Simply because someone is in a coma doesn't mean that they're doesn't mean that they're brain dead. So you can be in a coma, but what we're talking about is technically brain stem death, where the brain stem does not respond to stimuli, and we're unaware of any people who come back from that kind of injury. And so they are declared dead and then removed from life support systems. And once the machines are no longer breathing for them, once the machines no longer keep the heart pumping, once respiratory functions cease, then we say that they are dead. And so Ray was dead as a result of the multiple gunshot wounds. You all are coming, you know, said this before, and this is another sort of concrete example of that. You all are coming to this profession at a time when science is evolving every day. And so while most of the time the definition of death under the Harvard Medical School works, it doesn't always work. And we have a concrete example of that here in Massachusetts. We had a father and mother who were who were being tried for the death of their daughter, who I think may have been shaken baby, I'm not sure, declared, and I know the judge who declared her dead, but would not take her off of the life-sustaining, and she made a miraculous recovery. Polly, I can't remember her last name, or Holly, but yeah. Dr. Myers may know who it is, who she is, but I know the judge who went to the hospital, examined the child, listened to the doctors, and was prepared to declare her dead. And I don't know whether he, I believe that he did, but she miraculously, she became conscious, and her, you know, she's still damaged from the event, but she's also still very much alive. And so my point is that when talking about science and forensic science, you've got to be really careful. You can't assume that they got it right. Part of the reason I enjoy talking about homicide, you know, in part because it's fascinating to see what dumb things we do to each other, what awful things we do. But it's even more important now, because I know that we have executed innocent people. I know that any jurisdiction that recognized capital punishment, there has been at least one innocent person killed. So at any rate, you come at a time to this profession when you need to question everything. We're not saying that the science in terms of brainstem death is bad. What I'm saying is that simply because you have brainstem death doesn't mean that this particular brain is unable to regenerate. And one of the things that we know now, but we didn't talk about openly before, is that for children, for all people, but children in particular, nerves regenerate and are more likely to regenerate with children. And so if kept in some sort of state where there's an opportunity for regeneration, then it's possible. It's possible. Now, there are some conditions that there will be no regeneration, but we want to be careful, okay? So, any questions about the Fierro case? As I mentioned, Fierro is presented for you for a couple of, I should say, for a couple of reasons. One, it demonstrates that when we talk about homicides, that one of the things that the government will have to prove is that the defendant's actions were the proximate cause or legal cause of the death. So that's a requirement. The other proposition it stands for is that the definition of death is broader today than it was 50 years ago. I tend not to talk about the note cases that follow the main cases, but you should scan them, in part because Commonwealth versus Lewis, I believe, appears in one of the note cases here, and that talks about Massachusetts doing away with the year and the day rule. In Commonwealth versus Lewis, we had trying to remember. At this age, I start getting homicide cases confused. But at any rate, you had a young man who was severely beaten, and in fact, because of the wonders of science, did not rise to the level of brainstem death, but was treated for a number of years. And so he dies 4 years after the shooting, or the killing, the stabbing, whatever it was. And so the defense counsel argues that the person didn't die within a year and a day. And so the court says, we're abolishing the year and a day rule. There is no doubt in our mind that your client's actions were the substantial cause and the proximate cause of this person's death. And so the year and a day rule doesn't make sense today. I'm reminded of a, I'm not so sure I should call him a friend or not, but I remember a young man that I grew up with who had what appeared to be a relatively minor gunshot wound to the leg. And many of us did not understand why they didn't simply remove the bullet, and he lost the entire leg, and he lost the entire leg because of lead poisoning. So, you know, you want to be careful. Dr. Jack died, a couple of weeks ago, Kevorkian. And that sort of brings us to the cases at 442 and Washington versus Glucksberg. So, Blanca?
In this case, I have something with respect to the physicians for Washington State and the Attorney General in response to the physicians practicing in Washington State. And the issue at hand was the Washington's prohibition against aiding suicide up in the 14th Amendment.
Okay. In English, what does that mean? I mean, I know that that's legally the issue, but in English, what does that mean?
Is there a right to die?
Okay. Is there a right to die? And also, if doctors assist people with this, can the doctors be charged with murder? So those are, you know, that's what's really going on here. So what does the court say about this right to die?
They say that there really isn't quite a right to die. It's in terms of the assisting, it says that the state has an unqualified interest in preservation of human life. So something like assisting a suicide, the doctor would be held accountable for it. But
there's a difference between the assisting suicide versus allowing someone to refuse treatment, which would eventually lead to death. I hope that it will be something like chemotherapy. Well, what we're talking about is the sort of proactive, doctors in a proactive way assisting someone in taking their life. And the court, what does the court use or point to suggest that that can't happen or shouldn't happen?
The rule saying that a person is guilty of promoting a suicide attempt when he knowingly causes or aids another person to attempt.
Okay. And how many jurisdictions have suicide statutes? Pretty much all of them. Okay, so anytime you're looking at a case, in particular a constitutional case, a federal case, we're looking for precedent. The court is looking to see how states have historically dealt with a problem. And so pretty much every state has a ban on suicide. Now, it's hard to prosecute anybody for it if they're successful, but, you know, historically there were penalties for that, and some of that comes out in this case, that even though the decedent is no longer with us, frequently the survivors pay the penalty for someone committing suicide. So we've got a long history of being against suicide. So that's one problem. The other problem is that as science evolves, we have the capacity to keep people alive longer than they would have lived 50 years ago, 40, 30, 20 minutes ago. So it's evolving. And so part of what this case is sort of examining is the tension between do not resuscitate orders and patient-assisted suicide. And so the sort of affirmative, proactive piece does not, the court says that patient-assisted suicide is not a constitutionally protected right. And whose right is it anyway? Okay? The doctors are worried about their rights. What about the rights of the decedent? How do we know that the decedent doesn't change his or her mind at that last moment and can't? We will read a case where something like this happens, where a person says that they're willing to deal with the consequences, but at the last moment decides that they cry for help. And but they've given instructions that when I cry for help, ignore me. It's just me being weak. Okay. So the court is in a conundrum. And so all it can do is to look to precedent and decide on whether we are going to have patient-assisted suicide and whether that's protected by the Constitution. And in this case, we are told that can't happen. So you should all go back and read this case carefully so that you're clear about what you can and can't do. The same thing for the companion case, which I think is out of New York, where essentially the same argument is being made. So you want to be careful about what you can and can't do with terminally ill people. Yes?
I
mean, there's
an organization called the Dignitas, and I think it's Switzerland or Sweden or something like that, which... I mean, Hemlock? Yeah. Dignitas, I was looking at it online. I can maybe a couple of them. But, and they said they'll take people out of country to assist in suicide. Would the United States have any jurisdiction, or say, like, an American goes and decides to die in Europe with that?
That's part of that is what we call a conflict of law, but part of it would also depend upon whether there were, and as you go through civil procedure and stuff, you'll talk about this, but one of the questions will be, one of the critical questions will be, are there any U.S. citizens involved in that process at all? Because the U.S. citizens would be bound by U.S. law, and in particular, the state. We all live in a state where there are local rules, local laws. And so the question's going to be, typically a person who is contemplating suicide as a result of an illness cannot get to Europe, Switzerland, or whatever, without the assistance of someone. And so the person assisting is going to be under U.S. jurisdiction. Well, that reminds me of something else as well. And there's no good time to talk about it. The law forever has recognized a concept known as jury nullification. Jury nullification. And with jury nullification, the jurors ignore the law and find somebody not guilty, in spite of the fact that there is evidence of guilt. There are a few states, very few, that will allow a jury to be instructed on this authority that they have. But there are very few. Most states will not allow you to give a jury the instructions that they can ignore the law. But every jury has the right to nullify the law. The reason that the concept of a jury of our peers is so important is at that particular time, they represent what the law is. They decide the validity of the law as it pertains to a particular situation. And if a jury comes back with a not guilty on facts that would seem to suggest guilt, the prosecution is just flat out of luck. And so, it happens. It happens. There are people today talking about, can Whitey Bulger get a fair trial in Massachusetts? And when they ask that question, they assume that because of all the publicity, that anyone here would convict him. But if you listen to the stories in the press, you will see that there's still a group of people who see Whitey as Robin Hood. And so, will he get a fair trial? It's a good question, but not for the reasons that most people think. I fear jury nullification. Now, because this is federal court, it's the people won't come just from Suffolk County. They'll come from all over the state to serve on the jury, or at least all over eastern Massachusetts. But if the jury were limited, the selection of the jury were limited to Suffolk County, I'd be afraid. Be afraid. Let's lay out where we're going on Wednesday, because we're going to have to go through a bunch of cases on Wednesday. So we'll start with Keeler, and we will go through all of the implied malice cases. And so you've been reading this stuff all along, so what I'm saying is not going to be particularly impressive. But at a minimum, I'm hoping to get through at least up to the 526, and if possible, I'm going to push through that as well. So you've got a day, a full day and a half to get those cases ready. It's not going to take that long to go through them, but we will go through them because you need the concrete examples of how the rules apply. You already have the rules, but now we got to see if you know what to do with them. Yes?
In the syllabus, it says 436 to 516, and then we skip to 545.
Okay.
And you said 520.
Well, I apologize.
Okay.
I mean, whatever is in the syllabus, and I tend not to bring it with me.
Oh.
So I apologize for any confusion that I may have wrought, but actually today is one of those days when I did bring it with me. So, yeah, all of those readings. My hope is that we will get through pretty much all of that. So I'll just go around the room like a whirling dervish, and I'll expect you all to be ready so that we can enjoy our talk with Dr. Myers on Thursday. So I think it'll be interesting. I'll call her this evening and remind her, because I'm supposed to do that. But this is important, and once we push through the cases, if there's something that you don't understand, or as I try to push through, you should stop me if something is unclear. Because this is, as a practical matter, this probably becomes at least a third of your final. So you got to know it. And as I said earlier, I always have a homicide question. So, all right, have a good evening. And thank you for pretending to be attentive.